Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, it has been another day of shoveling the deck, actually two decks, since the other shoveler in our house has sciatica. It's nice out there, though. The blue sky after a snowstorm. It looks like we have more snow in the forecast, too. So if you can, get out and enjoy a snowy night under the moonlight. I have some eye surgery coming up this week, so I'm going to continue to do double feature episodes till I'm all better. The stories tonight or today, depending on when you are hearing this, are about a sculptor and a writer. First up, we have the November 13th, 2020 episode from Ken Lane titled Concrete Jesus.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. And if you're lucky enough to be in the mountain desert west this week, this month, with snow-dusted mountains all around and the sun shining in a crisp blue sky, well, you have paid for the sins of the summer, and this is your reward. Moaning wind on a November night, the first sweet chill of autumn. And just like that, before you ever thought about getting up on the gravel roof and putting the cover over the swamp cooler, it's cold. Here around Joshua Tree in Yucca Valley in Pioneer Town this week, we woke to snow on the mountains, a snow-covered San Gorgonio so recently on fire, and that light desert dusting you get on the lower hills or around the pinyon juniper tree line, where the pinyons meet the Joshua trees, boulders and black brush. Is there a more beautiful kind of wild land in the world? Everybody's got their favorite, so I don't want to imply that one favorite landscape is better than another. It's just my favorite, and it might be yours. Walking around, breathing that fresh, cool air, clean, damp sand in the washes, and patches of clean, white snow in the shade of the Joshua trees. Watching the dog delight in the fact that it's not only cool out, but there's some snow to nose around in, even roll around in if there's a big enough patch. Up in Missoula, they were digging out of the snow that morning. Ski season was about to start up at Mountain High in the Southern California mountains, but then a worker got the Rona and they had to delay that a bit. All across the Mountain West, though, the good news arrived. The seasonal good news, anyway. Let's think about another time. Let's think about the later decades of the 19th century. The year 1887, 133 years ago now. Another lonesome child was born in this strange and still mostly wild country. Cincinnati was the place, a boomtown on the Ohio River. It wasn't long since one of the deadliest and most destructive riots in American history, the courthouse riots of 1884. The Civil War was only two decades in the past, the California Gold Rush was over, and the nation had grown to 50 million souls, many of them hungry, most of them feeling like they'd been had. The late 1800s were a strange time, like all times in America, unsettled and angry, with the usual populations taking the brunt of it, the poor, as always. The emancipated slaves and defeated American Indians, especially. Veterans of the war between the states on both sides, of course, veterans always get it. Each wave of new immigrants, too, Chinese railroad workers, Japanese and Portuguese fishermen, Irish house servants and hookers. There were massacres, mostly of Native Americans and occasionally of U.S. cavalry. Massacres of labor protesters at Haymarket Square. There were pandemics and great fires in the squalid cities. The Old West legends became legends as they were killed off one by one. Wild Bill Hickok in Deadwood, Billy the Kid in New Mexico, Jesse James in Missouri. Every decade there was another national or global financial collapse, along with exciting new technologies and new business monopolies that would supposedly make the world a better place. It was a big country, impossible to govern and impossible to keep the crooks out, as there were few in power foolish enough to operate in good faith. In 1876, Samuel J. Tilden had been elected president, or so it seemed. But there was a riot in the Electoral College. With only 2 days remaining before the new president was to be sworn in, per the Constitution, and after months of lawsuits, alleged scandals, and angry demonstrations over the contested results from 4 states, Rutherford B. Hayes was appointed president. On the condition that the southern states should be immediately released from Reconstruction. The nation and the world, as ever in our industrial age, was filled with woe. But a person of no means, of no name, could still show up in a mining camp somewhere in the territories and maybe get a second or third or last chance. The lonesome child born in 1887 was an orphan. One of 255,000 souls in a city that 50 years earlier had only 2,500. Near the turn of the century, most likely 1899, the boy child ran away from a foster home and headed west. In a time before your every movement was tracked and recorded by the device you willingly carried night and day, it was easy to disappear completely. Where someone spent their formative years was mostly a matter of personal narrative. The people who lived and worked in railroad camps and mining towns and busy ports could make their own stories about themselves, and they did. The literary works of Mark Twain are rooted in these tales of the uprooted prospectors and con artists and gamblers. Well, this boy, who by age 12 was living as an independent adult, he drifted here and there, all the while studying whatever meager books came his way. Scripture, of course. There was always a Bible around somewhere. And newspapers filled with delightful tales and illustrations of the wider world. You might find a volume of Shakespeare or some poetry collections. And those who could recite monologues and poetry by memory were always welcome at the hobo camp, at the fireside. Well, years passed in toil that is lost to time, but around the age of 28, this boy, who would go by either Anton or Frank, made his way to the Black Mountains of Mojave County in the new American state of Arizona. Here at a mining camp called Oatman that had been producing a little bit here and there for half a century, the new technology was used to strike gold for real. A $10 million find. Frank, or Anton, we don't know what he was calling himself by then, was one of many drifters and laborers who stopped at Oatman and stayed a while. Long enough for it to become part of his short biography, but he left no lasting mark, and after the men and machines had torn all the then available gold from those mountains, some $700 million worth in today's inflated dollars, the mines were closed and the remaining workers sent off to the war effort for the Second World War. That's what became of Frank, or Anton, although we don't know how long he lived and worked in Oatman or when exactly he left. But if he did not find riches in those mines, he did find love, or at least companionship, which is the better of the two in the long run. It was in Oatman that he met and presumably married his wife, as was the unfair custom of so much of the 20th century. She is relegated to a nameless Mrs. and what flimsy records exist today. We do know the name of his wartime employer, Douglas Aircraft Company. For the war years and for many years beyond, Anton toiled by day in the manufacturer of bomber planes. As post-war jubilation almost immediately became the endless, teeth-grinding, existential dread of the Cold War and mutually assured nuclear destruction, an even better and more profitable business for the war captains who'd done so well making A-bombs and aircraft carriers, because it never ends. Anton's spiritually corrosive day job began to eat away at him. He was, like most Americans of the late 40s and 1950s, unsatisfied and unsure of how to address it. He wrote poetry, he spoke on scripture and other philosophical topics when asked, but his factory work brought new ideas to mind, using new forms of engineering. all around him in the spreading industrial and residential suburbs of Southern California, he saw new buildings going up quickly and cheaply using concrete and thin iron rods, rebar, which gave a poured slab or wall the strength to withstand earthquakes or hurricanes, maybe even atomic war. Blocks of marble were not routinely delivered to working-class defense industry employees. Concrete and rebar, on the other hand, could be had cheaply and delivered right to your driveway in Inglewood. And that's where Frank Anton Martin built his 10-foot statue of Jesus. 5 tons of metal sticks and ready mix. He had somewhere picked up the dubious information that reinforced concrete could stand up to an atomic bombing. In those days, when an abundance of good-paying jobs, for white Americans at least, caused a surge of new amusements for people with ample time off work, the local papers were always looking for local stories of human interest, new fads, new consumer trends. By late 1950, with Frank Anton Martin's giant statue of Jesus complete in his driveway, the newspapers had a funny new subject. Despair over nuclear annihilation had prompted Martin first to build his California version of Christ the Redeemer, and then to find an appropriately American home for the thing. Having lived in the Arizona desert near the Colorado River, the Grand Canyon came to Martin's mind. It was a wonder of the world, a symbol of America. And so this self-trained sculptor got to work on donating his sturdy statue of Christ to the National Park Service for installation on the rim of the Great Canyon. And the plan went nowhere. Soon the local papers were describing the unwanted Christ. When Life magazine would get around to the story, the article said the separation of church and state was the reason given by Grand Canyon National Park for refusing his statue. Although there's no evidence it went that far, none that I've seen. While many amateur sculptors have managed to get their crude creations atop local hilltops, especially if they were in the simple shape of a cross, the standards of the National Park Service have generally, if not always, been higher. And they're also supposed to follow the Constitution of the United States. You might recall the decades-long legal battles over an ugly scrap iron cross bolted to a boulder next to Tetonia Peak Trail on Sema Road in what is now Mojave National Preserve. Being the universally recognized symbol of the Christian Church, it obviously violated the constitutional separation of church and state and government business. The supporters of the cross came up with the flimsy excuse that it was really a veterans memorial. Well, asked the world, then why didn't you make a veterans memorial instead of a Jesus cross? Should we build a 500-foot-tall statue of the devil, naked and anatomically correct, and call it a war memorial? Perhaps we should. At least we'd have the right God involved. Anyway, Martin's great dream had to be downsized. And in the unincorporated high desert of Highway 62 in Southern California's San Bernardino County, a local preacher named Eddie Garver got wind of Martin's dilemma and offered not only a home for the unwanted, enormous concrete Jesus, but eventually, a home for both Martin and all of his philosophical and artistic ambitions. Reverend Garver homesteaded 5 acres of Bureau of Land Management property on the south-facing slope of the small settlement people called Yucca Valley. And here he would have his country Bible church and a grand decoration for it, Martin's Concrete Jesus. Oh, it was big news in those days of 1951. Life magazine did not just write a blurb, its editors sent out photographers and reporters to document the entire journey from Antone Martin's Englewood driveway to the spot in the high desert where Christ would finally rise after all these years. To be fair, he made the whole journey risen, standing upright on a flatbed truck, ropes binding him to the vehicle as it made its slow way through the howling winds of Gorgonio Pass, and then up the steep grade to the Mojave Desert. And then the crowd gathered round, or whatever crowd could be found in 1951 Yucca Valley, and they dragged Jesus Christ up the boulder-strewn mountainside, breaking off his fingers in the process. Frank Antone Martin scurried along beside his great creation, patching up the damage with a bucket of ready mix. It was a weekend before Easter. Nobody knows why they could not wait another week. Maybe Life magazine had other plans. Nevertheless, Martin spoke to the assembled Christians and curious, and then he went home. A year later, this time reportedly on Easter, Martin returned and spoke to the members of Reverend Eddie's Bible Church. This time, perhaps realizing how good the publicity was for a church that was small, even by Yucca Valley standards, Eddie Garver said, "Come on out and fill this whole hillside with biblical statues." Martin immediately envisioned his favorite scenes from the Gospels rendered in white concrete. Jesus suffering the little children, the Sermon on the Mount, the Last Supper. And so he moved to Yucca Valley, moved to that south-facing slope on what we now call Sunny Slope Drive, and built his sculpture park on the land opposite the church. But the partnership turned sour between Reverend Eddie and Antone Martin. The cause is unclear, but within a few years, Eddie Garver had sold his homesteaded acreage and crude chapel to another family who wanted to go at the religion business, including the original Big Jesus that was officially on Garver's land, not Martin's adjoining acres. Martin, now in his 70s and weary from a life of toil and wandering, died in 1961. He is buried in the 29 Palm Cemetery, which is weird when the actual monument to his life remains in Yucca Valley. It's called the Desert Christ Park and is in the care of a small nonprofit today. By the turn of our century, this century, Desert Christ Park was in grim condition. The fingers, the least sturdy part of Christ and his disciples, were all in terrible shape. Rusted rebar jutting out of broken and dirty concrete arms. The faces had collapsed on many of the statues in the enormous earthquake of 1992, the Landers Quake, that more or less ran right through the statue garden, made it clear that these statues would not survive the nuclear apocalypse. They would not even survive the bored teenage vandals who bashed away at the holy figures during the many decades when nobody much gave any thought to Yucca Valley. It sure wasn't on anybody's vacation list. But a dozen years ago or so, modest and somewhat regular work began to repair and maintain the statue park. As I witnessed myself the day after the election, when Brendan Mays and I dropped by after lunch to walk amongst Jesus and his disciples, amidst the Joshua trees and some now mature olive trees planted on the site for a Holy Land feel, The park I saw was cleaner than it has been in many ages. Many of the statues have been patched up and repainted white. There are some marked trails meandering around the figures today, which helps with the terrible erosion that happens every time it rains a few drops around here, which it does every now and again. The church next door is quiet, at least on weekdays, and the view of the surrounding Little San Bernardino Mountains is lovely. Yucca Valley holds about 25,000 souls now, and not all of them are retirees at death's door. Some people even move here on purpose now. In these strange years when the harsh Mojave Desert is considered beautiful by the younger generations, and when the cities are emptying out due to the plague and the outrageously expensive real estate and all the other problems we deal with in our dreary workaday world. Frank Anton Martin lived a singular life, even as he was very much part of the society of his time. Uprooted Americans headed for the fading frontier, working in mining boom towns and menial labor, and then settling in the biggest boom town of all, Los Angeles, the city built by a war against faraway Japan. He was a thinking man, and the weight of the world was heavy upon him, as it is for anyone who surveys our human activity and finds it wanting. Finds it nothing more than greed and hate and war and destruction and resource extraction and anxiety. The park is open daily, free to all, sunrise to sunset. It's a peaceful spot in a town that has few such places. Whether you visit it as a curiosity or a place of contemplation, please pick up your cigarette butts and dog waste and sports drink jugs when you depart. You've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. The soundscapes you heard during tonight's program were by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. We broadcast from Joshua Tree on KCDZ 107.7 FM Friday nights across the high desert, 10 to 11 p.m. We have a Patreon that is the sole means of support of this operation, so if you like the show, log in to patreon.com/Desert Oracle or come to our website, desertoracle.com, click Be a Patron. Our book is going to be out in just a couple of weeks, Desert Oracle Volume 1. You can pre-order it on your favorite book-selling website. Doesn't have to be the big A. And our new issue is on sale around town and by mail. Number 9, Desert Oracle. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the good weather and good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, at 95.9 FM. I hear there are some sculpture gardens in Montana worth visiting. The Blackfoot Pathway near Lincoln is one, and another is Tippett Rise in Stillwater County. Have you been to them? I think I should get to those places. The autumn snow is falling, and I'm already planning my 2025 travels. Okay, let's balance that out with another dip into the past. Our next half hour is an episode of Desert Oracle Radio from November 14th, 2022. Ken talks about Jack Kerouac in this one. He calls Desolation Peak.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. A cold Mojave night, the wind howling outside, a fire going inside. The more space between you and the rest of the busy, busy, frantic world of continual nonsense, the better the condition of your soul. Before we go off in some various directions, I want to tell you about our last Desert Oracle stage show. One more Desert Oracle Radio live show on stage Thursday, November 10 at the Los Angeles Central Libraries Auditorium. I did not know it was the last one when I said yes to this booking, but who really knows anything? The reasons I'm not doing the stage show anymore are pretty simple and ultimately trivial and in some part financial. You might have heard about this inflation thing, which has affected everything but the amount they pay for the entertainment. But also because it's a lot of hustle, and that's against my religion. Because it's about 10 hours of dodging Amazon Prime semi-trucks on the interstate. Before a one-hour show, followed by empty cities with all the restaurants closed, and I'm wondering if the neutron bomb finally went off. I've had my share, thank you. Supposed to stay on the back roads anyway, the blue highways, if compelled to leave the desert compound. So, Thursday, November 10, Zebulon presents Desert Oracle Radio at the LA Central Library's Mark Taper Auditorium. Now, whoever Mark Taper is, people have ignorantly put his name on about 7 different public spaces in Los Angeles. This one's at the Central Library in downtown LA. Doors at 6, show at 7. You can be back home watching your streaming programs before 9 if you hurry, hurry. And at least when I saw him last weekend, Red, Blue, Black, Silver said he's playing the show, so it will be the last show with him, too. He swore on a stack of, I guess it was parking tickets. So thanks for coming to these shows. Thanks to Merrick at the booking agency for setting up the stuff. You should always try new things if they are offered to you, but you can't keep doing stuff if it's not what you're supposed to be doing, especially if it's against your religion. Good Lord, I feel like most of what I do is the opposite of what I'm supposed to be doing. How did that happen? Why deal with enormous global conglomerates to publish books when I used to do it myself? Well, I have a radio show on all these transparently evil tech platforms. And then have to hold your nose and go plug this stuff on these vile billionaire social networks. You do your work and you hope people generally understand the point, but spend 8 years doing this kind of stuff and it slowly becomes apparent that most people are utterly missing it, even if they're listening and reading. Missing the point, I mean. This is not the Woodsy Owl Show. It's probably a disclaimer that should be on the label. No hustling. Don't do it. Don't hustle for anybody and don't hustle for yourself if you can help it. Hustling was something you did in Times Square or behind the liquor store. For $5 or $10, you know, Midnight Cowboy. No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. Don't worry, what you will eat or drink, what you will wear, is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns. And yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. Don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. That's from the Sermon on the Mount, by the way. The staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, as Leonard Cohen described it. And speaking of red, blue, black, silver, the soundscapes you hear on this radio program are composed and performed by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Alive I ever feel when it's so natural I don't even think about it is when there's a surprising or even everyday encounter with the wildlife. Now, yesterday, as I was wrapping up a dreary afternoon of answering emails and dreaming of what kind of household poison I could eat to avoid ever looking at email again, something big flew up under the patio eaves and began a search of the boards and beams, looking for some of the bugs that appeared after our recent rains, the last insects before winter. I sort of crawled across the floor very slowly to not startle the bird outside, and good Lord, what a huge woodpecker, I thought. I was about a dozen feet away, looking into the sun and through the window, which needs cleaning and etc. But finally, I got a good enough view to see it wasn't a woodpecker, and it wasn't a giant mutant cactus wren. It was a flicker, a northern flicker. I've never seen one on this little patch of high desert land before. An enormous bird. like all woodpeckers, full of weird energy and probing intelligence and a wonderful sense of fun. It looks like fun to me, anyway. I hope it decides to hang around for a while. Later, taking the evening hike with the dog, our old buddy the Lonesome Coyote tracked us for a mile or so. And then when we rested up at the Rock Bowl, my name for a place where nobody else ever goes, this very handsome coyote sat about 20 feet across from us, tucked its tail underneath, and just watched us, and eventually started looking around at birds going by. And well, I think Lonesome Sue is sort of in love with my dog, is my feeling about it. Sadly, my dog is fixed, as they say, meaning medically altered to prevent the one thing animals and other people are programmed to do, which is reproduce. So, there will be no coyote dogs from this long simmering romance. What a beautiful coyote, though. If a domestic breed ever had half the beauty, half the elegance, half the intelligence, well, I guess it would be a regular domestic dog, which I'm grateful for as well. Let's see, we're supposedly talking about events. Here we go, coming up on November 18, finally, Friday evening, November 18, a camp meeting in Moab, Slick Rock Country, the Canyonlands, Grand County, Utah. We've got a whole weekend of interesting community work. You still go broke doing this stuff, but at least it's for a good cause. In this case, it's a fundraiser for our radio home in Moab and the Castle Valley, KZMU-FM 90.1 FM and 106.7 FM. Campfire tales like we used to do all the time and love more than anything. But for baffling reasons, they have never returned for Desert Oracle except in one place, Utah. We did one earlier this year at Green River on the river at nightfall, just a beautiful evening for the Epicenter community event held there. And now we've got Friday, November 18. At a campground on the edge of town. It's a small town, Moab is, so the campground is very close. In fact, that's where I took a very pleasant half-day walk when I was last in Moab. All proceeds support KZMU Community Radio, where you can hear this program, Desert Oracle Radio, on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. And then on November 19, that next Saturday, at 7 p.m., a free event at the Grand County Public Library, 257 East Center Street in Moab, in partnership with Back of Beyond Books. Some storytelling, some readings, book signing, etc. And then maybe somebody will take me out for drinks. Someplace kind of upscale, like Woody's Tavern. Go to DesertOracle.com and click Events. There will be links to each of these events, these final Desert Oracle events on the calendar. I'll be doing something else in the future, St. Sophia willing. Because the new year has arrived, the new year marked by Samhain, or Samhain in the original Danzig dialect. All Hallows Eve to the Day of the Dead, from dusk till dawn, Samhain, Samhain, etc., with some variation from the Irish to the Scots Gaelic to the Echo Park witches at the Airbnb down the road. Everybody's got an opinion. And there's nothing quite so rewarding as keeping your opinion to yourself, close to your heart. A new year, a new time, turn over a new leaf. Not a leaf falling off a tree, although that makes seasonal sense. But the leaf of a book, a new page, a page of a book, turning a new page, goes back to the 1500s in the English language. A new leaf, a new page. On the summer of 1956, an utterly broke writer by the name of Jack Kerouac got a lead on a summer job uniquely suited to a wandering philosopher who was trying to get his life together, trying to get his spiritual affairs in order. The job was seasonal fire lookout on Desolation Peak in the North Cascades, Washington State. He took nothing but notebooks for his journals and his prose and his poetry, and a copy of the Diamond Sutra to study. No alcohol, which was a real sacrifice for Kerouac. No human contact beyond the weekly bull session on the Fire Lookout network of two-way radios. The novel that covers this period of his life, a whole year before his old manuscript On the Road is finally published and completely upends his life and sparks an entire generational social movement that he never understood, but did not particularly endorse. Well, the novel is called Desolation Angels, and it has long been one of my favorites. Especially the long section that opens the book about his time as a fire lookout for the U.S. Forest Service. Well, I pulled it off my bookshelves late in this long, dreary summer, and I got pulled right back into that world. The world of Kerouac's romantic prose, the whole thing. I have a trade paperback from 1980, and somehow that has survived 30 or 40 changes of address, changes of everything else. And the cover is faded from decades of desert sun bleaching through the windows. The page is dog-eared like all my favorite books. I was trying to figure out when this edition was published, and to my delight, I learned that Rare Bird Books in Los Angeles and the Kerouac Estate were just about to publish Desolation Peak, a collection of his original Fire Lookout journals, along with his translation of the Diamond Sutra and a bunch of Mountain Meadow poetry and Mexico City blues that had not yet seen print. So I asked Rare Bird if they'd send one over. And I've been enjoying it during the peaceful hours this week and last. The book's out next week, November 8, 20 and 22, so check your local independent bookseller or Rare Bird Books on the internet. And I'm going to read a little bit from Desolation Peak. And if you're not familiar with Kerouac, then maybe you'll see why it matters. Hear why it matters. Why, it matters so much to so many people, whether you're talking about Patti Smith or Bob Dylan, T-Rex or Richard Linklater, Kristen Stewart or Tom Waits, The Doors and The Dead and The Sonic Youth, Ella Fitzgerald and Jolie Holland, Lana Del Rey. Desolation Peak. Summer 1956. Desolation Blues and 12 choruses. Here's number one. I stand on my head on Desolation Peak and see that the world is hanging into an ocean of endless space. The mountains dripping rock by rock like bubbles in the void. And tending where they want, that at night the shooting stars are swimming up to meet us. Yearning from the bottom black, but never make it, alas, that we walk around clung to earth. Like beetles with big brains, ignorant of where we are, how, what, and upside down like fools, talking of governments and history. But Mount Hozamine, the most beautiful mountain I ever seen, does nothing but sit and be a mountain, a mess of double-pointed rock. Hanging, pouring into space. Oh, frightful, silent, endless space. Everything goes to the head of the hanging bubble with men. The juice is in the head, so mountain peaks are points of rocky, liquid yearning. And if you don't like the tone of my poems, you can go jump in the lake. I have been empowered to lay my hand on your shoulder and remind you that you are utterly free. Free as empty space. You don't have to be famous. Don't have to be perfect. Don't have to work. Don't have to marry. Don't have to carry burdens, don't have to gnaw and kneel. From the Desolation Journals. Full moon, white snow, my bottle of purple dessert. The work of the world and my work is to celebrate life by celebrating the enlightened guts of the living. In my prose reportages, and appraise the golden eternity by praising the enlightened guts of the dead. Saturday, July 21. Wrote joyously, absorbed and with care on the big slim part of Ozone Park manuscript. Oh God, all I asked for was my work. Is that too much? Today I'm making, I hope, arrangements to go down trail 4 miles, meet patrol boat, and pick up my smokes. A little weird flower, why did you grow? Who planted you on this goddamned hill? Who asked you to grow? Why don't you go? What's wrong with your orange tips? I was under the impression that you were supposed to be some kind of perfect nature. Oh, you are? Just jiggle in the wind, I see. At your feet, I see a nosegay bouquet of 7 little purple apes who didn't grow so high, and a sister of yours further down the precipice, and your whole family to the left. I thought last week you were funeral bouquets for me. I never asked to be born or die. But now I guess I'm just talking through my empty head. just finished my new transliteration of Diamond Cutter. Birds fly over the shack rejoicing. Such places where the scripture is observed, however wretched they may be, will be loved as though they were famous memorial parks and monuments to which countless pilgrims and sages will come to Desolation Peak. I got a letter from Jason Blatzheim. Blatzheim? I think that's how you say it. In Winnemucca, Nevada. Oh, I miss Winnemucca. He says, hello, Ken. Really dig the podcast magazine, my kind of weird. I've noticed recently you've been into Kerouac. Well, I've always been Kerouac enthusiast since about 1980 or 81 or so. But yes, it's true. Recently, I've been pulling out some books. Anyway, back to the letter. Never argue with a letter, you know? Who does that? And thought you might enjoy this documentary about Kerouac's time in Big Sur. It's yours now. Hey, thank you, Jason. And he sent this box that looks like a book, and there's a DVD in there, so I'm gonna roll the TV out of the closet one day coming up, and we're gonna put that on the DVD player. From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness and the whole American Southwest, this is Desert Oracle Radio. I'm your host, Ken Lane. Nobody else shows up, so. And my own little fire lookout tower. Looking out at the little San Bernardino Mountains, which were beautifully covered in a light coating of snow on Thursday morning, just as the sun was rising. We broadcast Friday nights from our home station in Joshua Tree, Z107.7 FM, that's on your FM dial, and I'm mostly back in the desert for the rest of the year, so I'm working on that Desert Oracle number 10 periodical. Good night from the voice of the desert.
So Jack Kerouac is one more writer I want to read more from. Of course, Montana is not short on great writers either. A couple of my favorites will be showing up in Bozeman in person soon, but I'm not going to tell you who or where. Just keep checking out local bookstores, the library, and the university events pages. You never know who is going to be showing up until you look. For now, my thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to KGBM and its supporters for hanging in there and being true to its mission. And thanks to you for listening. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Hey, don't let the crazy things you see or hear get you down. Just don't, okay? We need you here. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain stories for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams.